Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now we continue our 30 Issues election series. Issue 27, free trade agreements are bad, or is it good, for American workers. According to most reviews of the two presidential debates, Donald Trump's best moments were the first moments of the first debate when he went after Bill and Hillary Clinton on NAFTA and Hillary Clinton's flip-flop on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that 11-nation trade agreement, while Secretary Clinton argued that even NAFTA has been a good thing.
Your husband signed NAFTA, which was one of the worst things that ever happened to the manufacturing industry.
That is your opinion.
You go to New England, you go to Ohio, Pennsylvania, you go anywhere you want, Secretary Clinton, and you will see devastation where manufacturing is down 30, 40, sometimes 50%. NAFTA is the worst trade deal maybe ever signed anywhere, but certainly ever signed in this country. And now you want to approve Trans-Pacific Partnership. You were totally in favor of it. Then you heard what I was saying, how bad it is, and you said, I can't win that debate. But you know that if you did win, you would approve that, and that will be almost as bad as NAFTA. Nothing will ever top NAFTA.
That is just not accurate. I was against it once it was finally negotiated and the terms were laid out. I wrote about that in...
You called it the gold standard.
You called it
the gold standard of trade deals.
You said it's
the finest deal you've ever seen.
No.
And then you heard what I said about it, and all of a sudden you were against it.
Well, Donald, I know you live in your own reality, but that is not the facts. The facts are, I did say, I hoped it would be a good deal, but when it was negotiated, which I was not responsible for, I concluded it wasn't. I wrote about that.
So is it President Obama's fault?
Now, Clinton's version there of her gold standard position on TPP was widely fact-checked. She did, in fact, say this, speaking in Australia in 2012, even before the TPP was negotiated.
This TPP sets the gold standard in trade agreements to open, free, transparent, fair trade, the kind of environment that has the rule of law, and a level playing field. And when negotiated, this agreement will cover 40% of the world's total trade and build in strong protections for workers and the environment.
So she did call it then the gold standard, not something she hoped when it was negotiated might be the gold standard. But that argument, gold standard trade agreement, because of protections for workers and the environment with enforcement under the rule of law, remains the rhetorical bedrock of the TPP supporters, even if Clinton has walked away. Here's President Obama in April of last year.
It's the highest standard trade agreement in history. It's got strong provisions for workers and the environment, provisions that, unlike in past agreements, are actually enforceable.
Obama still hopes to get the TPP passed after the election in a lame duck session of Congress when many members who quietly support it can do so with less political risk. But if Clinton is elected, Obama will have to lead the lame ducks over her objection. Here are the two main reasons that Clinton gave on the PBS NewsHour when she abandoned the TPP last October.
We have lessons to learn from them.
Sorry about that. That was the wrong clip. Let's go on. Well, we'll play that Obama clip because here he talks about TPP in relation to NAFTA and that it's better.
We have lessons to learn from the past, and we have learned them. But trying to stop a global economy at our shores isn't one of those lessons. We can't surrender to the future because we are meant to win the future. If America doesn't shape the rules of the global economy today to benefit our workers, while our economy is in a position of new global strength, then China will write those rules. I've seen towns where manufacturing collapsed, plants closed down, and jobs dried up, and I refuse to accept that for our workers because I know when the playing field is level, nobody can beat us.
But China was one of the main reasons that Clinton gave on the PBS NewsHour when she abandoned the TPP last October.
I'm worried about currency manipulation not being part of the agreement. We've lost American jobs to the manipulations that countries, particularly in Asia, have engaged in. I'm worried that the pharmaceutical companies may have gotten more benefits and patients and consumers fewer. I think that there are still a lot of unanswered questions. What I know about it as of today, I am not in favor of what I have learned about it. So for the larger issues and then what I know, and again, I don't have the text, we don't yet have all the details, I don't believe it's going to meet the high bar I have set.
So let's say TPP fails. That doesn't stop American companies from creating jobs in China and even lower paying countries in Asia or around the world rather than here. They've been doing it for years. And it certainly doesn't make jobs already gone come back, which moderator Lester Holt asked Trump about in the first debate.
American manufacturers, how do you make them bring the jobs back?
Well, the first thing you do is don't let the jobs leave. The companies are leaving. I could name, there are thousands of them. They're leaving, and they're leaving in bigger numbers than ever. And what you do is you say, fine, you want to go to Mexico or some other country, good luck. We wish you a lot of luck. But if you think you're going to make your air conditioners or your cars or your cookies or whatever you make and bring them into our country without a tax, you're wrong. And once you say you're going to have to tax them coming in, and our politicians never do this because they have special interests, and the special interests want those companies to leave because in many cases they own the companies. So what I'm saying is we can stop them from leaving. We have to stop them from leaving, and that's a big, big factor.
Clinton opposes new taxes on imports by America. Her plan, in the context of her new opposition to TPP, has many elements. The first thing on her website is invest $10 billion in what she calls Make It in America partnerships involving business, labor, colleges, and government. She goes on to list creating apprenticeship training and crack down on companies that ship jobs and earnings overseas and create incentives for companies to bring jobs back, though she doesn't specify how, and tax incentives to encourage investment in communities that have faced or are about to face significant manufacturing job losses. Clinton also now embraces free public college for most Americans who want it, to lift more people into higher skill jobs, not as subject to export. Clinton has enough of a sense of humor about her flip on TPP that she agreed to participate in this skit on the Funny or Die Between Two Ferns satire with Zach Galifianakis.
First, you supported Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, and then you were against it. I think that people deserve to know, are you down with TPP?
I'm not down with TPP.
No, you're supposed to say, yeah, you know me. Like the hip-hop group.
Don't tell me what to say.
Clinton with Galifianakis on the specific flip on TPP. But what's her larger vision? The WikiLeaks release last Friday of excerpts from those high-dollar Wall Street speeches revealed her ultimate free trade and immigration goal. She told the bankers behind closed doors, quote, "My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders sometime in the future," unquote. Her campaign chairman, John Podesta, tried to dismiss that as out of context on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace.
Here's what she said in a big money speech to a Brazilian bank. "My dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders. Just think of what doubling the trade between the United States and Latin America would mean for everybody in this room." John, open trade,
look,
open borders?
Look, I mean, you could pluck a few words if that's what she did say out of context, but I think she's put forward and has been for and has constantly championed and voted for comprehensive immigration reform that modernizes our border security.
So let's compare the candidates to each other. The public and private Clinton to herself, and political and economic reality now. For some context, we have New York Times political correspondent and former Obama White House correspondent Jackie Combs, who has reported extensively on the politics of the TPP. Jackie, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me again.
What WikiLeaks revealed that Clinton told the bankers, that her dream is a hemisphere, a common market with open trade and open borders, is that the first time you've heard anything like that from her?
No, not at all, especially since, you know, going back to the 90s when I covered Congress and her husband's White House, and his work for NAFTA was one of the signal achievements, as he himself saw it, of his administration, and she was foursquare behind that. You know, open trade and open borders, I guess I can make an argument that that's not in conflict with where she is now. She just wants to argue that it has to be, in order to get there to that open trade and open borders, you have to have restrictions or requirements on our trading partners that, police against unfair trading practices that would then, you know, cause job losses or lower wages here in this country.
And that's the Wall Street position and the Wall Street Journal editorial board position generally, right? Open markets and open borders, because it's, for them, the most advantageous thing for the investor class?
Right. But I would say it's, the support for that concept goes broader than my former colleagues at the Wall Street Journal, is that, you know, as the President Obama likes to say, among many others, is that, you know, we think of ourselves as a really big country, and we are, but we're 5% of the world population. And so an economic powerhouse like the United States cannot have closed borders and closed trade, because we need to sell to that other 95%. I sound like I'm making the argument for this, but, you know, the fact of the matter is, whether you like a particular trade agreement or not, there has to be international trade. And the fact is that for as toxic as this debate has been in this election year, through the primaries into the general election, what has really surprised me is that polls continue to show that a plurality or even a majority of Americans favor not only trade, but international trade, but trade agreements per se. And I think what that shows is it's very similar to issues like gun safety and immigration, that the people who are opposed to things like gun controls, liberalized immigration, and free, quote-unquote, free trade, feel very strongly about that, and they will vote based on that one issue, and the politicians hear from them, whereas the mass of Americans that tell pollsters they're in favor of, you know, reasonable restrictions on guns, some letting down of our immigration restrictions, and trade, free trade, they aren't as motivated by those issues. They think it's a good thing, but, you know, doesn't mean they'll vote based on that issue.
In the Clinton and Trump clips, the Clinton and Obama clips, praising TPP or TPP in its formative stages, in Clinton's case, they included the word enforcement as one of the reasons that they thought this could be a gold standard of trade agreements. And I see that your latest article about TPP just last week was about President Obama emphasizing his enforcement activities on existing trade deals as a way to win support for TPP. What are some of those enforcement actions?
Well, he most recently, in September alone, it was a confluence of things. They had took new action on against China and its subsidies, as we see it, as the United States sees it, of grains like rice, wheat, and corn. And so took them to the World Trade Organization, which is sort of the global courtroom for enforcing trade agreements and free trade. And so we've taken that case to the World Trade Court or the World Trade Organization. And in the same sort of time frame, there were a couple cases where the WTO handed down decisions in earlier cases that the administration had brought to it that were a win for the United States. And for instance, the big one was India. India had sort of banned any solar parts for solar power that were made any place other than India, which was costing a huge number of exports for the United States. And the Obama administration won in the court, and India lost, which means it will have to pay tens of billions of dollars to the United States or change its practices.
Why does President Obama really support the TPP? He's got no sympathy for companies shipping American jobs away.
Right.
And he's not a free market ideologue who thinks markets lift all boats if left to their own devices. So why does Obama cling to this despite the opposition of so many other Democrats?
Well, you know, I have to think that he, especially given what he's up against in his own party, and increasingly in the Republican Party, which historically has been a free trade party, I have to believe that he truly thinks it will, that the right trade agreements will be good for the economy, and actually a number of economic studies buttress that, that, you know, you're bound, you lose jobs, but you gain jobs as well, and as he argues, and with some economic studies, again, to back him up, that the jobs that are created in export industries, industries that are, you know, mainly export their product or at least a large part of it, those tend to be higher paying jobs. And so he says that on balance, this is not only a good thing, but it's an essential thing, given that we are, like I said, only 5% of the world's population, and we can't just sell to ourselves.
So if Obama is right and rational on the merits that we get more benefit to our export economy than we lose from manufacturing jobs going away from free trade in general, and I realize that's a generalization even attributed to economists because these deals are so complicated.
Yeah.
But if that's generally the case, as Obama and many economists argue, how do you explain the rank and file defections in the Democratic Party and how widespread they are?
Well, I think it's sort of, you know, and I'm a native of Toledo, Ohio, so, you know, I get this. I've seen it in my own, you know, family and my friends growing up. It's a case where what no one really likes to say much is that a lot of these manufacturing jobs are gone, especially the lowest skilled ones, are gone and aren't coming back. And the president has tried from the stimulus bill of his first months in office onward to really make an argument for manufacturing jobs and for subsidies and tax incentives and partnerships that will, as you mentioned, some in the tapes that introduced this segment, that will encourage you know, new manufacturing ventures with more skilled labor in manufacturing, but also, you know, so that people keep jobs here. But some of these jobs, they're going or they're gone and they're not coming back. And people don't like to address that. And we need to, you know, focus on the things that, you know, we can do in this country. And for that, we need more skills. You know, I've separately done stories, which was sort of a surprise to me, and you can see it in the data almost every week. A number of jobs are going begging in this economy because the employers can't find workers with the skills to do them. I even did a story on, I mean, this was a shock to me, about how much drug testing is prevents people from being able to hire, because so many people either can't pass the test or won't come in and take it because they are afraid they won't pass it. I mean, those kind of things, skills and the ability to be to do the job need to be addressed as well. But trade becomes a convenient boogeyman when we're living in these uncertain times. And so for the Democrats and Republicans to be abandoning trade is completely reasonable, considering how anxious so many Americans are about their wages and their jobs.
One of the Clinton folks' defense of her Wall Street remark about hemispheric open trade is that she may have that dream for when conditions could be made right for it, but she still acts as a practical person in the real world. So, for example, as a senator, she voted against CAFTA, the Caribbean Free Trade Agreement. Do you know why she voted against CAFTA? Do you know why?
Well, she said in that case, much like she has said about TPP, that it was about, you know, fear that it wasn't going to be good enough on wages and that it, you know, wouldn't increase wages here and wouldn't prevent job losses. But there's an additional consideration in CAFTA, which also comes into play in TPP, which is sort of the human rights and worker rights issues. You have countries like, you know, Colombia, in that case, or so the Central American Pact, you had Mexico, Colombia, some of the other countries where unions in this country and their counterparts in foreign countries have been really have really worked hard to improve human rights in those countries, because there's not just persecution or just harassment of people who try to form unions or make unions stronger in those countries where they exist. There's even assassinations, and not a small number of assassinations. So, you know, Guatemala, Colombia, Mexico, that has continued to be a concern, and that was a concern for Hillary Clinton in the case of CAFTA.
Last thing, it would be an early challenge for Clinton, assuming she's elected and the Senate goes back to Democratic control, if the TPP, if there's a real attempt to pass it in the lame duck session by Obama and the current Congress. And I guess my question is there a length to which she would have to go to satisfy opponents in actively getting in there during the lame duck session before she's sworn in to fight it, so she isn't accused of secretly supporting it, kind of winking at a process that she isn't technically included in?
I have to say, I guess, that I think she does have to make a good show of opposing it. And, you know, I think President Obama would expect that she would, you know, would understand that she would have to make that show, because this has been perhaps the number one issue in terms of questioning her credibility on a substantive basis. I mean, and I think she does, but you've got, and I think I'm about ready to call TPP dead, except I won't, because there is that little sliver of a chance that something could happen in the lame duck Congress.
Our 30 Issues election series, Issue 27, Free Trade Agreements Are Bad, or Is It Good for American Workers? We'll continue with it later in the week. Jackie Combs, New York Times correspondent, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll continue in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and even if the presidential campaigns and most of the media are deciding to focus only on scandal, the Brian Lehrer Show will continue to talk about the issues as well. And let me be clear, the day-to-day campaign developments matter. We are discussing it on this show, as we did in our last segment. What I hope makes us different is that we also continue to take deep dives all the time on the real issues that affect Americans' lives directly. That's why we instituted our 30 Issues in 30 Weeks series to begin with, to ensure a safe space in which we will not get distracted by campaign headlines, no matter what they are. We've been doing that for at least two segments a week on each issue since the spring. We did four last week on immigration, which was issue 26. And now we continue with our 30 Issues election series, issue 27, what was supposed to be a central issue in the campaign, which candidates could be spending much more time debating, free trade is bad, or is it good, for American workers. Let's listen to some history. The first protectionist law that most of us learn about in school was the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act of 1930. Now, we don't have archive tape going back that far, but we do have the 1986 movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
In 1930, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives, in an effort to alleviate the effects of the Great Depression, passed the tariff bill, the Hawley-Smoot Tariff Act, which raised tariffs in an effort to collect more revenue for the federal government. Did it work? Anyone know the effects?
Mr. Bueller, I don't expect you to have the answer. Oh, but look who has his hand up. Yes, Mr. Gore?
In 1930, when the proposal by Mr. Smoot and Mr. Hawley was to raise tariffs across the board to protect our workers, and I brought some pictures, too.
Mr.
You brought
Ross
some pictures?
Is a protectionist?
This is a picture of Mr. Smoot and Mr. Hawley. They look like pretty good fellas. They sounded reasonable at the time. A lot of people believed them. The Congress passed the Smoot-Hawley protection bill. He wants to raise tariffs on Mexico. They raised tariffs, and it was one of the principal causes, many economists say the principal cause, of the Great Depression in this country and around the world.
Al Gore from his 1993 debate about NAFTA against Ross Perot. Smoot-Hawley imposed tariffs on imports as high as 60% in 1930. Now, tariffs had long been an issue in American politics. As we'll hear from a free trade historian who will join us in a few minutes, they pitted northern manufacturing states that wanted protection from low-cost imports against southern slave states that wanted low tariffs for its agricultural exports. More on that later. But back to the 20th century. Here is a 1938 clip of FDR Secretary of State Cordell Hull, who pioneered the modern free trade agreement. His home state of Tennessee stood to benefit, but he also framed the relaxation of Smoot-Hawley in the late 30s in the context of the rise of Nazism in Europe. Remember, this was 1938.
The task of rebuilding our foreign trade requires caution and infinite care. It is necessarily a slow process. In a world headed steadily in the direction of narrow nationalism, with all its attendant disasters for the well-being of our country and of all countries, we have taken a position of leadership in an effort to reverse that fatal trend. Our work has borne tangible fruit. But the stupendous task involved was only partly completed when a widespread war again broke out. That calamity has imposed upon us new tasks and new responsibilities. While hostilities are in progress, it is necessary for us to defend our export trade from the inroads of wartime controls and dislocations. For this purpose, the trade agreements now in effect are of inestimable value. The need for facilitating trade and for keeping alive the principles which underlie the trade agreements program is of crucial importance.
A deep archive clip of Secretary of State Cordell Hull in 1938. World peace continued to be used as a rationale for free trade agreements under the theory that it would solidify the alliance among the free market nations of the world during the Cold War, and because countries that have mutually profitable trade relationships are less likely to go to war with each other. Here is President Lyndon Johnson in his 1968 State of the Union address referring to the so-called Kennedy round of trade negotiations that lowered tariffs between many non-communist countries.
Since I spoke to you last January, other events have occurred that have major consequences for world peace. The Kennedy round achieved the greatest reduction in tariff barriers in all the history of trade negotiations.
President Johnson in 1968. Now let's get more to NAFTA. In 1993, the U.S. and Canada had recently sealed a trade agreement lowering tariffs just between the two countries, and Mexico wanted in. In that Gore-Perot debate that year, moderated by CNN's Larry King, after Clinton and Gore were elected, Perot, a businessman, described how he could exploit American workers more easily if NAFTA was passed.
When I'm in a room with corporate America, the first thing they say is, Perot, why don't you keep your mouth shut? You could, with your resources, make more money than anybody else. Here is the NAFTA game. Buy U.S. manufacturing companies cheap right after NAFTA passes, that are labor-intensive, that make good products, that have marginal profits. Close the factories in the U.S., move the factories to Mexico, take advantage of the cheap labor, run your profits through the roof, sell the company's stock at a profit, go get another one.
That's what they do now. That's what they're doing right now.
That's what they're doing right now. Did you hear that? That was Al Gore's reply there. We hear the same argument today about the Trans-Pacific Partnership from President Obama, as Gore used there in 1993. Globalization is happening anyway. We might as well have a say in setting the rules. Now, the president of Mexico at the time, remember, was still in 1993, was Carlos de Salinas Gortari. As Perot and organized labor argued that NAFTA would kill jobs, Salinas argued in an MIT commencement address that it would create them. And you'll hear at the end of this clip, he throws in another sweetener for a U.S. audience. It would reduce Mexicans' desire to immigrate to the United States.
NAFTA is an environment improvement agreement because with additional resources, we will take better care of our environment. NAFTA is a wage-increasing agreement because we are committed to increasing real wages in Mexico more than they have increased up today when NAFTA is ratified. And NAFTA is a migration reduction agreement because Mexicans will not have to migrate north looking for jobs in this country, but they will be able to find them in my own, which is my own main commitment.
Mexican President Salinas in his 1993 MIT commencement address. NAFTA, of course, passed. Here's President Clinton at the signing ceremony addressing the fears of the opponents and promising to enforce labor and environmental protections.
When I affix my signature to the NAFTA legislation a few moments from now, I do so with this pledge to the men and women of our country who were afraid of these changes and found in their opposition to NAFTA an expression of that fear. What I thought was a wrong expression and what I know was a wrong expression, but nonetheless represented legitimate fears. The gains from this agreement will be your gains too. I ask those who oppose NAFTA to work with us to guarantee that the labor inside agreements are enforced. And I call on all of us who believed in NAFTA to join with me to urge the Congress to create the world's best worker training and retraining system. We owe it to the business community as well as to the working men and women of this country. It means greater productivity, lower unemployment, greater worker efficiency, and higher wages and greater security for our people. We have to do that.
After NAFTA, Clinton went on to negotiate more global free trade under the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade that many nations participate in. The same skepticism about jobs, wages, and the environment persisted. A major demonstration grabbed world attention in Seattle in 1999 against the whole global free trade regime. So how would the Clinton administration sell it to the American people? Well, there was no WikiLeaks then to reveal the behind-the-scenes strategy talk, but I'd say the West Wing character, Toby Ziegler, pretty much nailed it.
You want the benefits of free trade? Food is cheaper.
Yes.
Food is cheaper. Clothes are cheaper. Steel is cheaper. Cars are cheaper. Phone service is cheaper. You feel me building a rhythm here? That's because I'm a speechwriter. I know how to make a point.
Toby.
It lowers prices, it raises income. You see what I did with lowers and raises there?
Yes.
It's called the science of listener attention. We did repetition, we did floating opposites, and now you end with the one that's not like the others. Ready? Free trade stops wars. And that's it. Free trade stops wars. And we figure out a way to fix the rest. One world, one peace. I'm sure I've seen that on a sign somewhere.
Thank you, West Wing, circa 2001. One selling point for free trade agreements was that even if some jobs would flee and some wages would be depressed, Americans as consumers would have a lot more things to buy as imports at cheaper prices. Capitalizing on the increasing number of free trade imports, for example, was the nation's largest retailer, Walmart. Here's an example of a Walmart commercial from the year 2000.
Gray skies are gonna clear up, put on a happy face, brush off the clouds and cheer up.
Rolling back prices because we know how much you like to save. Walmart, always low prices, always.
Walmart sales pitch in 2000, rolling back prices. At the same time as his administration was nearing its end, President Clinton argued for bringing China into the World Trade Organization. A key concern at that time that we really don't hear at all today wasn't that China would be a massive low-wage competitor to the United States, but that China was a human rights violator in its own country and therefore should be ostracized from the world economy. President Clinton addressed this in arguing for China's inclusion in the WTO in 2000.
It does deny its citizens fundamental rights of free speech and religious expression. It does define its interests in the world and sometimes in ways that are dramatically at odds from our own. But the question is not whether we approve or disapprove of China's practices. The question is, what's the smartest thing to do to improve these practices? I believe the choice between economic rights and human rights, between economic security and national security, is a false one. You know, as we debate about China here, and we love to do it. It absorbs a great deal of our time and energy. It's easy to forget that the Chinese leaders and their people are also engaged in a debate about us there. And many of them believe that we honestly don't want their country to assume a respected place in the world. If China joins the WTO, but we turn our backs on them, it will confirm their fears.
Bill Clinton in 2000. Hillary Clinton's issues with China today are so different, as in when she explained her decision to no longer support the TPP on the PBS NewsHour last October.
I'm worried about currency manipulation not being part of the agreement. We've lost American jobs to the manipulations that countries, particularly in Asia, have engaged in. I'm worried that the pharmaceutical companies may have gotten more benefits and patients and consumers fewer. I think that there are still a lot of unanswered questions. What I know about it as of today, I am not in favor of what I have learned about it. So for the larger issues and then what I know, and again, I don't have the text, we don't yet have all the details, I don't believe it's going to meet the high bar I have set.
So the debate continues between Clinton and Trump when they're not obsessing on each other's alleged scandals. He is still knocking NAFTA, and she is still defending it as the opening, as in the opening moments of their first debate.
He approved NAFTA, balanced budget, which is the single worst trade deal ever approved in this country.
Incomes went up for everybody. Manufacturing jobs went up also in the 1990s, if we're actually going to look at the facts.
And that's our brief audio history of free trade politics in our 30 Issues election series, Issue 27, Free Trade is Bad, or Is It Good, for American Workers. Let's talk about this history with I.M. Dessler, public policy professor at the University of Maryland and author of books including American Trade Politics. Professor Dessler, thanks so much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure.
You wrote a piece this spring in the Harvard Business Review tracing the free trade debate back to the slavery era. Can you talk about the relevance to that?
Well, it was related to slavery, but I think the South, as the central cotton producer in the country, which was a major U.S. export in the 19th century, was would have been for free trade in any case, slave or free. But you did have a division between the beginnings of manufacturing in the north of the country where people wanted to protect the industries and the cotton, which was highly competitive and felt that the open trade policy would lead to more exports. And in different ways, this division continued into the 20th century, and it meant that for a good while, Democrats were the supporters of free trade, and Republicans who represented the industrial constituency were against it. Now, that has changed more recently.
Listeners, if you want to ask a question or say something about the history of free trade in the United States or protectionism, 212-433-WNYC, if you have a history or an analysis question. Professor Dessler is here for that, or say what you want. 212-433-9692 here in our 30-issue series, Issue 27. Smoot-Hawley in 1930, was it a response to the stock market crash of 1929?
It was not entirely that, although people represented it as that. It sort of began as a feeling that they needed to protect agriculture a little more, which was in Great Depression at that time. And then it sort of mushroomed because a lot of industries wanted protection. Congress was willing to provide it. And if you provide it to one industry, you provide it to another. So it all sort of got bigger and bigger until in the end, the average tariff on products where we charge duties was 60%, which is incredible. Now it's well under 5%. And the result was not to improve the U.S. economy, to make it worse. The Great Depression was already beginning, but Smoot-Hawley, by universal analysis, I think, made it worse.
Tariffs today are under 5%, so all this to do about TPP and other trade agreements is just to take off a couple of points of a tariff?
Essentially, that's right. I mean, the
Most of the tariff reduction has already occurred through a series succession of agreements, including the Kennedy round that President Johnson was talking about, including a round completed under President Clinton, the so-called Uruguay round. And so tariffs are actually quite low. Now, there are other barriers to trade, other trade restraints that TPP and earlier agreements try to deal with. So it's not just a matter of tariffs, but basically, the economic impact of TPP is grossly exaggerated by its opponents and to some degree by its proponents as well. It is not going to make that much difference for the U.S. economy.
So why are the two sides so dug in?
That's a very good question. There developed after NAFTA, after the critics of NAFTA, organized labor, some environmental groups, some human rights groups, lost the battle of NAFTA. They continue to mobilize. They continue to be active. Your video mentioned the big demonstration in Seattle, which essentially closed down the town and closed down a World Trade Organization conference then, and slowed up movement toward further trade negotiations. And so you had this emerging opposition, and there has been, over time, there has been a lot of job displacement in particular parts of the United States. Some of it is caused by trade. Some of it is caused by technology. Moreover, although President Clinton talked in the clip you said about creating the best job trade retraining program in the world, the United States has not done that. We have something called trade adjustment assistance, which helps some workers displaced by trade, but not all that many. And generally speaking, particularly under conservative control of the Congress, programs that spend money have not gotten very much interest. And to do a really good job of comprehensive job retraining would be billions of dollars, maybe $10 billion or more a year, whereas we're spending one or two right now.
Huh. So when Obama sells TPP as the gold standard of trade agreements because of better labor environmental standards and better enforcement of those, and Clinton used to agree until she disagreed, do the facts bear him out? Have you read the 30 chapters of the 11-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership?
I've read a good bit of it. I can't say I've read every word. I've read summaries, and I've read, and the it does definitely have stronger labor and environmental standards than any other trade agreement we have put forward. And it, because the United States is less protected than at least some of the countries in terms of its own market, this means the United States, relatively speaking, is a winner in that people talk about leveling the playing field. Trade people like to talk about that, and this does level the playing field to a significant degree, making other countries relatively more open, making us more open too. But since we're, as you pointed out, very, very open already, the balance of benefits is for us. The problem is, for selling it, is the bottom line is not huge. It's maybe 1 or 2% of GDP total. And that's nice, over spread over a long period of time, but people won't really notice it.
Do you think NAFTA has been a net plus for United States workers, or would you have to separate that out into big baskets of winners and losers?
You would have to separate it out. Now, what Hillary Clinton said was absolutely correct, that in the years after NAFTA, U.S. employment went up enormously through the Clinton administration. Some of that was manufacturing employment. Most of it was not. And there were certainly those who were vulnerable in the sense of relatively low wages, and industries that were labor intensive tended to lose. Those that were more high tech, that were more advanced processes and so forth, tended to be winners. And so it's a matter of this distribution of benefits, and you see this more generally in the United States, and it's reflected in the presidential campaign. Large parts of the country have been beneficiaries of globalization, particularly along the East and West coasts, and they're in contrast to a number of areas, particularly toward the center of the country or the Midwest, who have been on balance sufferers. But again, there are a lot of exceptions within those. I mean, in Ohio, you have a lot of job loss from over the years, over the decades, from trade and from even more probably from technology change. But you have also communities that have moved ahead in services, moved ahead in ways that have they've gotten beyond this. And the notion that Trump suggests that you can bring these manufacturers' jobs back is totally impossible. I mean, it's just like it's not the only thing he has suggested that's totally impossible, but that certainly is.
My guest is University of Maryland public policy professor I.M. Dessler, who has written, among other books, American Trade Politics. As we continue with our 30 Issues election series, issue 27 this week, free trade is bad, or is it good for American workers? And we'll go to the phones in just a minute, but I just want to answer a question that came in from a listener on Twitter, and you can follow us at Brian Lehrer. But somebody said, wait, those Perot versus Gore clips you played. Was Gore, as the vice presidential candidate, actually debating the third-party independent presidential candidate, Ross Perot? And the answer is, as I actually mentioned in the essay, President Clinton and Vice President Gore had already been elected. And Gore and Clinton were trying to get NAFTA through Congress, and Gore agreed to go on television and debate the failed third-party presidential candidate, Ross Perot, which, looking back on it, is really, really remarkable that that ever happened, isn't it?
It is, and well, Perot had written this book, which suggested, again, wildly exaggerating, that millions and millions of jobs were at risk under NAFTA, and therefore, and so he was a vocal critic of it, and a highly visible critic of NAFTA. He'd been so during the election campaign as well, and so he was a good target. And Gore thought correctly that he could beat him in a debate. Now, some people thought that it was a risk because by that point, support for NAFTA was coalescing. The administration was probably going to win anyway, but the Gore victory over Perot, and it was universally regarded, regardless of people's views on the subject, that Gore had won the debate. That kind of clinched the case, and NAFTA won congressional approval by a larger margin than anybody had expected.
Linda, on the Upper West Side, you're on WNYC. Hi, Linda.
Hi. My concern is something that doesn't seem to be getting much publicity, and that's the investor dispute resolution process, where a tripartite panel of corporate attorneys on leave from their jobs will have total decision-making powers with no appeal through the U.S. court system. And foreign companies can sue for loss of projected income, and it's already been invoked under other trade agreements for things like the vetoing of the Keystone Pipeline, and we've had to change some of our laws to avoid paying fines for, I think we had to pay a fine for the banning of, what is it, MTBE in gasoline, and we've overturned laws that for country of origin labeling of meat, all because we would have had to pay huge fines. And I'm wondering why the loss of the sovereignty in this country has not gotten more publicity in the talks.
Professor, do you agree with her characterization of what that investor dispute resolution system would produce?
Briefly on the investor state resolution. This has been in many trade agreements. The number of cases where the U.S. Interests have lost out or people have really been very small. Many of these cases get thrown out. It's been a favorite subject for critics of the agreement, but the actual case is pretty thin in terms of if you look at all of the possible disputes, all of the possible investments around the world. Now, in terms of loss of sovereignty, there is something here. I mean, the whole notion that we would agree to lower our tariffs and bind our tariffs at a lower level so that we are essentially breaking our international commitments if we raise them. That is a limitation of sovereignty. The whole point, the way that trade agreements work, is we agree to limit ourselves and other countries agree to limit them and we get mutual benefit.
So for example, if a country is putting a lot of state subsidy into an industry that competes with American products in the same industry that is not getting government subsidies, then they would agree in many cases to give that up, in effect giving up a little bit of their sovereignty to get whatever benefits they get from the agreement.
And similarly with labor and environmental commitments, which are mainly things that we already do, the protections we already provide, and so others are giving. So it is a mutual, a lot of international agreements involve limitations of sovereignty, but we're in a global world.
But then what you just said kind of reinforces the caller's point that at least in theory, we could enact a really good environmental protection law that then gets thrown out in an international court under a free trade agreement, right?
It could happen. It could happen. It hasn't happened very often. And there are serious people who are looking at ways of addressing that. But it's a question of how if you make commitments that do tie your hands on certain issues, mainly on economic issues. And, for example, there are provisions in TPP involving internet freedom, free use of the internet. Now, our country, we have free use of the internet. Other countries tend to restrict it sometimes for political purposes. Mm-hmm. Now, they are then losing some sovereignty over that in the agreement. I think that's good. I think that's in our interest. It's probably in their interest, and also in terms of our promoting open societies, open communication. But again, it is a constraint that people accept. Now, if you believe that your country should never enter agreements that tie its hands in any way, then you're basically saying we should isolate ourselves, because that's what international agreements do. They do tie your hands.
Mark in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Yes, I would like to make a commentary regarding the way free trade is done in the old days as compared to NAFTA. In the old days, from what I can recall, the American investors would, for example, build a factory in a third world country. They would own the factory. They would monopolize the know-how, the production processes, et cetera. The top level management of that factory would be staffed mainly by Americans, and the lower level, by the nationals. Now, what I've noticed is that the production process and the know-how are outsourced to the Chinese. The Chinese own the production processes. They own the factories. So, that gives them a lot of power. They then, in turn, export the products back to the United States to what I would call distribution companies like Under Armour or Apple. The Chinese then would not only export the stuff to here, but in other markets as well, like in other third world countries, in other developing countries, because they dominate there compared to America. In the old days, when a lot of people wanted to import stuff in other countries, they would simply come to the United States and, put in their orders, etc. But now,
Mark, are you saying that it was better when the U.S. own more of the local companies in whatever markets, and the local people in those countries work for them? Now there are more local subcontractors, like Chinese-owned subcontractors with Apple, and that's worse for the workers? Is that the point you're making?
I think so, because what I have noticed, like the Chinese, if you go to parts of Africa, they're creating environmental havoc there. A lot of corruption is going on. But they extract far more out of the poorer countries than what they would get, from the wealthier countries.
Yes, and I'm going to leave it there. Professor, any comment on that?
Okay, well, TPP does not currently include China, so that's not directly. But you have to look at the broader picture. upwards of 500 million people have come out of poverty in the world in the last 20 years. Trade has been a part of that, not the whole thing, but a lot of those are Chinese, a lot of them a lesser number, but a substantial number of people from India. But the movement, the globalization of the great economy has been a major benefit to many human beings. And so I think one of the ironies is people on the left say they're against trade, but they say they're in favor of, you know, of welfare for everybody. I mean, a good life for everybody. Well, trade has been one of the engines of that good life. And it is too bad that I think the way our politics has moved, that the Democratic Party has become very trade skeptical, because in the large global picture, there have been enormous benefits for hundreds of millions of human beings.
But does that support then, based on that argument, take a certain kind of liberal thinking, which says, well, the United States is so affluent, we can give up a little bit of our wage advantage in the world so that millions of Chinese can move out of poverty?
Well, I think some people might say that, but you don't have to say we're giving up. It is a question of certain products that we don't have. We are not as competitive in a world market because we may have higher wages and so forth. And so there is the whole notion that if we are a high cost producer, then under trade we lose out to countries that are relatively low cost producers. But because productivity in the United States is so much higher per worker than in other countries, we are still competitive in a large number of areas, and the workers get much higher pay in the United States.
So last thing, explain one of the things that President Obama says constantly about this 11-nation Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that is he emphasizes what you just said a minute ago, that it does not include China, and that this helps the United States set the rules of the global economy and weakens China's ability to do that. What rules?
Well, the rules of the global economy are substantially rules embedded in international trade agreements, but it's also an emerging set of rules on broader issues. I mentioned internet freedom as one example. Labor and environment is another that are covered in the TPP.
But if China's not in it, forgive me for interrupting, but we're running out of time. If China's not in it, and China is so huge, how does it change the game in terms of benefiting American workers?
Well, it benefits the United States and other countries who are in the agreement because they gained trade benefits, and the Chinese then are hopefully over time motivated to change their approach in ways that would make their economy less restrictive, more open, that would be the impact. So if we, on the other hand, if we back away, we're losing economic leadership in the area, and the Chinese norms are more likely to prevail, and other countries are going to have to make their deals with China because of its size and power.
By the way, you mentioned the Democratic Party moving away from trade. How do you see the Republicans? Because the Democrats have been the skeptics for a long, long time. Now we have the Trump movement, which is conservative anti-free traders. Do you see it as different?
It is certainly very different for a Republican presidential candidate. And Trump is more anti-trade, more scathing about it than any presidential candidate I can think of ever.
But is it different substantively, motivated by something different than liberal skepticism?
I don't. It's hard to know. It's not fundamentally different, except that it's much more sweeping, much more broad brush. It's interesting. If you look at public opinion polls, increasingly, Democrats across the country are for trade and Republicans are skeptical. It's very interesting because the Congress is the House of Representatives splits the opposite way.
Yeah, well.
But the actual public opinion has moved increasingly. Democrats are positive about trade and Republicans are more skeptical.
I think it's economics for the Democrats and nationalism for the new Trump conservatives.
Public policy is nationalism for Republicans more generally, but the Trump conservatives are an extreme version of that.
Indeed. Public policy professor at the University of Maryland, I.M. Dessler. He's the author of books including American Trade Politics. Thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure and very interested to listen to your questioners as well.
And we will continue to cover the ugly horse race until Election Day, but we will also continue our 30 Issues election series next week, Issue 28, here on The Brian Lehrer Show. Whose voting rights are being challenged this year?